My next guest is on the line. He is Glenn Segal, and he is a strategic affairs expert and Middle East analyst, as well as being a professor at the University of Cambridge. He wrote an article which was published in the South African Jewish Report very recently, all about Iran, and his insights are going to help us today understand a little bit more about what is happening in Iran currently and possibly how events may turn out. So, Glenn Segal, thank you for talking to us on Chai FM this afternoon.
Hello, Simon. It's a pleasure to be with Chai FM again. And the leading song was rather appropriate with the words, "It's just a dream." Hopefully for the Iranians, it's going to be more than just a dream.
Yeah, hopefully so. Although it does look like the very violent methods employed by the regime under internet silence appear to have quelled the riots somewhat, the unrest.
Well, so long as there is tensions on the street, and there's heavy tensions on the street, and they have hope that they will be able to make a change, I don't believe that the rioting actually has quelled that much. The reports came in early on this afternoon that the Iranian police chiefs have been given an ultimatum of 3 days for the demonstrators, the protesters, to subside. Or else there will be, in fact, an escalation of their methods in order to do so. So because of the silence, we think that we're not seeing anything in the media, and therefore, as a consequence, nothing's happening. But we're now into the fourth week of these protests and demonstrations, and it has spread rapidly. And from the indications of coming out of the morgues of the hospitals, I think that a lot of until the economy changes, put it this way, I don't think the protesters or demonstrations are going to stop.
What makes these, I don't know what the correct word is, this unrest different from the Mahsa Amini protests?
Well, progressively over the years, they've become more and more radical. And the reason being is twofold. One is the economy. The snapback sanctions, which came in October because of the end of the uranium agreement deal through United Nations with the Western powers, the five powers, has meant that since October it has become really, really bad economy. The foreign exchange, the rial of the Iranian currency, has collapsed totally. And the second reason which is happening is that there is progressively younger and younger generations which have less faith in a cleric religious regime. And have traveled abroad. They've experienced life outside of Iran. They've seen the world change since the revolution, since the end of the Cold War, since the Arab Spring. And they too want to move forward with the rest of the world, including the region. So those two combined elements, together with, of course, the international involvement. Trump has basically said, "I'm going to support you guys." And that has never happened before. No American president or no world leader at all has ever said to the Iranian protesters and demonstrators, "Carry on, help is on the way." And in fact, aircraft carrier battle groups are on the way. So I think the protesters, the demonstrators in the street level have a slimmer of hope this time that they can effect more change. Doesn't actually mean that they will be able to do so. And we have to also admit the fact that within Iran, there is a residual resistance to change because of vested interests. There's an entire class of people which rely on the Ayatollahs being in power. For example, the Revolutionary Guards. So we're seeing a very, very violent outburst between these two sides, which has never happened before.
Glenn, it was really interesting. I saw an article earlier today when I was doing a bit of research for this discussion. A woman who was killed, a correspondent for a particular newspaper, of which I've forgotten the name right now, but she was talking about the daily life of Iranians, and she was saying that her friends showered less, that it became, to that extent, the economic conditions of daily life was having an effect on their life. It wasn't that they were just earning less or that their money was worthless. They actually had to shower less.
Well, Iran is one of those countries in the region which actually suffers from a water shortage in any event. And by virtue of the fact that, you know, in South Africa, unless the government invests in infrastructures, for example, electricity and water, you are going to have load shedding in both. South Africa has experienced that, and Iran is also experiencing that due to the lack of investment of central government. The situation is different between Iran and South Africa is because Iran has the money. However, they are investing that money abroad to support international terrorist organizations and further the Islamic Shia revolutionary worldwide. So instead of developing infrastructures locally for things such as water, they are producing, selling, manufacturing weapons for Hezbollah, both in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Syria, and Hezbollah also has a foothold in Africa and in South America. So that is part of what protesters are actually saying. Bring the money home. Give us what our taxes are being paid for. Don't pay anyone else out of the country. So yes, there is a water shortage, and there always has been a water shortage in Iran, but this is compounded by the fact that the central government is not investing, especially further away from the cities. Tehran is not too bad, but when you get out into the provinces, the Turks don't care anything whatsoever about what people's lives are like out there, and they are suffering. They are suffering in food, they're suffering in water and electricity.
See, this is the part that I don't understand, is I never for one minute thought that the regime was suicidal. I always thought it was megalomaniacal, but not suicidal. And all it took was to say, okay, we'll give up on the nuclear program and we'll stop with the proxies. And they would have had billions and billions and billions of dollars flowing into them as foreign investment. And that would have been the end of that. It's remarkable to me that still at this point and as of today, they still are committed to that ideology of the circle of fire and nuclear armaments. Why?
You're quite correct, Simon. And if we had to step into the shoes of the Ayatollah just for a brief moment, we could actually imagine that they're so devoutly religious that they believe divine intervention and divine assistance will in fact assist them to remain both in power and to achieve the revolution. Don't forget, Islam actually believes that every single person in this world should be a Muslim. This is the ideology and the goal of the revolution. And they believe that by furthering that, they are God's representatives, Allah's representatives on earth, and doing so, Allah will protect them. They really don't believe anything different. That's on one side. But on the other side, we often look at why is the army, the police, Revolutionary Guard supporting them, even if they are not that religious. This is a Sunni Shiite debate and dispute. They are actually living in fear that Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, will invade them. They believe they do need these weapons. They do need nuclear weapons. They do need missiles to defend themselves against a Sunni invasion of Iran to end the Shiite Islamic sect of Muslim Islam religion. And these two things have put them in a paranoid situation that they can believe they can live in poverty, that people can be subjugated, people can be killed in demonstrations, and that Allah will protect them to the end. Yes, this is why I think President Trump said that Ayatollah Khomeini is sick. He actually is living in a world which is in what we would believe in secular or Christian and Jewish practices, something which is not realistic. You're quite correct, Simon.
I'd love you to address, in your article, you outlined six potential scenarios. I'd love you to quickly run through those for us so that we gain a better understanding of how this could play out.
Well, the one is the evolution of the regime. In other words, basically, this Ayatollah is old, you'll be replaced by another one. And eventually, it will actually believe in something more congenial lifestyle. A second one is that the fact that the army will collapse and stop supporting the Ayatollahs and hand over the weapons to the people, to the protesters, and say, look, we're not going to kill these people anymore. And there really is tensions to that extent. I believe about 500 to 600 security force people have been killed in these demonstrations. It's not only the protesters. Mm. The protesters actually are violently responding and killing security forces. Another one is international intervention. That essentially the United States or Israel, and Israel might be forced if Iran actually uses this as a scapegoat, to attack the leadership, the Ayatollahs. And that came out in the statement today, in fact, that the Iranian foreign ministry said that that will result in a worldwide jihad because the Ayatollah is a supreme religious leader. So that's international intervention. Another one is actually this erosion of the political system, that the Ayatollahs could, in fact, maintain central control of the state. But local economies will become more like Sicilian mafia, that essentially every town, every province will be run by local economies through rent-taking, through monopolies, and so forth. We also have something which has been experienced in the Western world since 1648, the Treaty of Westphalia, the end of the rule of religion of state, or the separation of religion and state, where the religion still maintains its position, but the state becomes entirely secular. And this has progressively happened in the European thing. It's known as the Westphalian state system, which is what we're currently in.
But that doesn't...
That might be a way...
Sorry, I was just going to say, that doesn't happen in Islamic states, does it? There isn't room for that separation, is there?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. You're quite correct. That is what we believe as being a utopia. This is something which United States President George Bush hoped would happen in Iraq. That if you topple one regime, that you're going to have institution building, you're going to have democratization, you're going to have processes voted by, the people have more say, capitalism and so forth. What did happen was in China. China recognized that the communist rule had to have an element of capitalism to survive and made that change. The Soviet Union didn't. So we look at all these different scenarios, which we say in academia is possibilities which could happen. But in reality, what we're doing is saying that all of those scenarios would actually be a combination in one way or another. So it's going to be a slow change, it's going to be a necessary change. There's a difference prediction and forecasting. Exactly when this is going to happen, and how it's going to happen, and how it unfolds can take a while. Don't forget the Soviet Union went in 1989. That's still in the process of change. Unification of Germany, for example, in Europe was a change. The European Union was a change until Britain left, Brexit. So all of these are long, long-term processes. But one thing is clear. The Iranian population no longer can live in this economic situation, and it has to change in one way or another. The Ayatollahs, as you said correctly, have to realize, recognize reality, or else they will be out. They will be out totally from power, that is. But the main point there is that they are clergy of the majority religion. So they will still have a say in what is happening in daily life. People don't want them to have a say in what is happening in foreign defense policy, because that's where the money is going to. So all of these are good scenarios, and hopefully we'll have a combination of them sooner rather than later.
Glenn Sigel, thank you for chatting to us on Chai FM. That was fascinating.